than union trade, says food body. Britain's small businesses should expect trade with the European Union to be permanently damaged from 1st of January 2022, the refrigerator supply chain trade body has said, after new customs checks take effect that it says will make imports from the bloc more expensive, less flexible and much slower. Amid growing public dismay at the negative impact of Brexit, the Cold Chain Federation, the CCF, said specialty food imports could face the same 70% decline that affected exports of food by small businesses this year after Britain quit the European Union's single market and customs union. Extra costs that amount to £300 to £400 for each consignment will mean sales of food to the European Union countries in small batches could become uneconomic, said the Cold Chain Federation, which lobbies on behalf of firms that transport frozen and chilled goods. The big casualty of these trade barriers is the businesses that need to import small and frequent quantities across borders. A pallet load of specialty cheeses or boxes of onion powder. This is the sort of trade that is going to suffer, said Shane Brennan, the Federation's chief executive. Business groups have called on the government to soften its stance in negotiations with the European Union to prevent a collapse in trade with the 27-member bloc. But while ministers have agreed to extend the deadline for veterinary checks on food crossing the border, there has been little progress on cutting red tape. Mike Cherry, the chair of the Federation of Small Businesses, said a survey in the autumn showed only a quarter of firms were prepared for the introduction of full import checks. We don't have any indication that the level of preparedness has improved, especially as the festive trading season has seen so disrupted yet again, he said, adding that one in five small firms that do business internationally have given up selling to clients in the European Union since the transition period on exports ended. Rising food prices have played a large part in the increase in inflation over the past 6 months, and economists fear higher import charges will push up prices further, forcing the Bank of England to increase interest rates at a faster pace than anticipated. The Consumer Prices Index reached 5.2% in November and is expected to rise above 6% in the spring as higher food import costs and an increase in gasoline prices push up the cost of living. This week, Simon Spurrell, a co-founder of the Cheshire Cheese Company, said the hard Brexit push through by Boris Johnson was the biggest disaster that any government has ever negotiated in the history of trade negotiations. Cheesemakers are among the subsectors of the food and drink industry to be hardest hit by new trade barriers. UK food and drink exports to the European Union fell by as much as 24% in the first 9 months of 2021, according to figures from the Food and Drink Federation, which said the slump helped knock the sector's exports by £2.7 billion between January and September, compared with pre-pandemic levels. The Cold Chain Federation's chief executive Shane Brennan said exports that occupy only a fraction of a container had suffered the most from extra customs checks on exports, and that was likely to be repeated when checks also apply to imports. Brennan said importers would need to satisfy safety rules, provide customer declarations, and have the necessary paperwork to ensure goods move through ports. And all these must be synchronized to prevent things from even getting slower, he said. Cherry said unless the government steps in with more support, the situation is set to worsen. The Institute of Directors said its economic confidence index had tumbled from -6 in November to -17 this month, a sign of nervousness among business owners about the United Kingdom's economic prospects. It said three-quarters of company directors in Britain expect costs to rise in the next 12 months, and most said they would raise prices to either fully or partially offset the rising costs. The Trades Union Congress, the TUC, said new checks on goods coming into the United Kingdom would damage the UK's position as an important trading nation and a drive to create high-payment employment. The Trades Union Congress's General Secretary, Francis O'Grady, said, "With goods coming into the United Kingdom facing new paperwork, we could see further supply chain chaos, potentially hitting jobs in affected sectors. Government must invest in the infrastructure and jobs we need now to prevent further disruption."
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. We're going to talk about manners, and obviously we will give some examples of good manners. Manners are an essential factor in societies, of course, and they play a very important role in the perfection of nations. Manners are crucial to humanity, and they are a part and parcel of man's nature. There is no doubt as to the fact that no one denies the vital role that manners play in bringing peace and happiness, as well as felicity and a better life to man. No one, in fact, doubts the useful and decisive influence of manners in strengthening and consolidating, and also in reinforcing the fundamentals of the integrity of conduct, the integrity of thinking on both the social and public levels. Can you find anyone in any place who has a felicitous life, who searches for happiness in the shadow of treachery and lying? In other words, can you find someone happy while he is lying? Can you find someone prosperous while he is treacherous? No, because happiness and treachery are contradicting attributes. They are opposing each other. They are traits that cannot coexist and cannot be together. Now, I would like to ask you another question. Can you find someone in the society who is dishonest and yet he has a respectable place in society? No, you cannot. Because, as I said, these are contradictory attributes and they cannot be combined in one place, in one individual. Happiness, prosperity, and lying and treachery and dishonesty cannot subsist together. Now, manners are so important that even the nations that do not believe in religion respect them and feel that it is essential for them to abide by some set of ethics, by some set of moral values, in order to be able to advance on the winding path of life. Welcome to your program For a Better Life. Moral attributes are not particular to one religion or to the followers of one religion or another. They are universal. Everywhere societies are found, and under all conditions, manners share some similarities. Whether you go to the west or to the east of the world, you find that certain attributes are despised, certain traits are disliked, and certain traits are liked and appreciated. Whether you are in America or Europe or in Japan or in China, you find, for example, lying and cheating to be bad, honesty and truthfulness to be good. So these attributes, these moral traits, are not particular to one religion or another, or to one nation or another. They are universal concepts. Most of the moral attributes are universal in the sense that there is a kind of similar perception about them in the world. There is a famous British scholar called Samuel Smiles. He says those who have reached the peaks of excellence and greatness are like bright lights clearing the way and guiding people toward the paths of morality and piety. If the members of a society anywhere lack good behavior, they will be unable to reach excellence regardless of how much freedom and political rights they enjoy. It is not essential for nations to possess vast areas of land to live honorably, for there are many nations with large populations who own vast areas of land yet lack all the necessities of perfection and greatness. Thus, if the morality of a nation becomes corrupt, that nation will eventually vanish. And this is said by Samuel Smiles. All agree with what this or many other scholars have said about excellences, about perfection, about good moral traits. Yet, there is a great difference between knowing the facts and acting on them, you know. Knowing that lying is bad, cheating is bad, and knowing that truthfulness is good, honesty is good, is something, and acting upon them is another thing. There are many people who substitute their animalistic inclinations in the place of good conduct. They substitute excellent morals for lusts, which appear in life like bubbles sparkling on the water surface. Now, there's a big gap between practice and theory, between knowledge and practice. And of course, if you are subdued, if you are overwhelmed by lust, you are going to act in a way which is in line with your physical desire. But if you are not overwhelmed by sexual, physical desires, then you are going to give room to your reason, to your intellect, to your faculty of reason. And in that case, of course, as long as the reason is governing, as long as you are following the command of reason, then you are going to follow what is in your best interest.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Man, in fact, has completely contradicting instincts. He is constantly the subject of a fierce struggle between the traits of evil and goodness. Now, the traits of evil and goodness are always clashing with each other within the human body, within the human skeleton. The first step to eradicate man's evil traits is to capture his lusts, to suppress your lusts, to control your anger in this battlefield, because your lusts, your anger, and your physical desires are the cause of the animalistic power. They are the cause of marginalizing the good traits. In order for a person to live a prosperous life, in order for a person to achieve victory in this battle, in this continuous and constant battle, it is necessary for him to give time and space and room to his reason rather than to his lust and anger. I'm not trying to say that, okay, man does not need lust. Anger and lust are a blessing in disguise. You know, they are needed. If a person does not ever become angry, he is imperfect. If someone doesn't have the lust, he is not, you know, a perfect individual, because all these contradicting attributes and traits are needed, but they have to be used properly in their own respective areas. It is incumbent upon anyone who wishes to achieve perfection to avoid extravagance on either side and to rid himself of the harmful inclinations that stem from such traits. There are evil traits. There are harmful inclinations that stem from those evil traits. It is necessary to rid oneself from those harmful inclinations. Of course, in the best interest of the individual, to change these traits into useful and beautiful feelings. The reason for this is that man benefits greatly from his feelings, but such feelings can only appear good if they are obedient to the commands of reason. We will discuss further in the following episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Ch
China has harshly warned Chinese Taipei against making moves towards independence. Beijing says it will take drastic measures if the self-governed island crosses red lines. Chinese officials say provocation by separatist forces in Taiwan and, quote, external intervention could intensify in coming months. Foreign ministry officials say China is willing to try its utmost to seek peaceful reunification with Taipei, but would act if any red lines on independence were crossed.
Well, crossing the red lines for China would mean that Taiwan would declare independence. And it would be, in reality, would be against Taiwan's constitution. In order to change Taiwan's constitution, it would need also to pass a referendum, which would need to have an approval of 75% of the legislative chamber. So at this stage, Taiwan's declaring independence is very unlikely.
Earlier in December, China's foreign minister stressed the need for Taipei to be reunited with Beijing, saying the self-ruled island is not a chess piece to be used by others. Wang Yi said the root cause of the new round of tensions lies with the island's authority that have attempted to solicit U.S. support for Taiwan independence. He also accused the United States and certain countries of deliberately using Taipei to contain Beijing. The top Chinese diplomat described Taipei's ambitions for independence as perverse actions and said the moves designed to change the status quo undermine peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait and violate the consensus of the international community as well as the basic norms governing international relations. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all the world countries recognize that sovereignty. The US too recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long courted Taipei in defiance of Beijing.
If you look at the largest companies, Taiwanese companies such as Foxconn and Pegatron, they have most of their workforce in the mainland. So it would be just an economical suicide for Taiwanese just to declare independence. And it's very unlikely. Independence is a planted idea by the US against China and Taiwan's interest.
The United States, which backs Taipei's secessionist president, continues to sell weapons to the island in violation of its own stated policy. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the US refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Instead, the US had an embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to establish formal ties in a bid to create a counterbalance to the Soviet Union. And at the start of 1979, the US gave formal diplomatic recognition to the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. In doing so, Washington recognized the PRC as the sole legal government of China. It also acknowledged Beijing's position that there is only one China and that Taipei is part of it. After the US cut off formal relations with Taipei, Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act. It has underpinned US ties towards the island ever since.
Well, the US policy regarding Taiwan is what they call a strategic ambiguity. It is officially respecting the One China policy, but in action, the US has clearly been undermining the One China policy by meddling into Taiwanese politics. The US has groomed President Tsai Ing-wen since 2004.
In recent years, the US has made China a top priority. The measure, known as the Pivot to Asia policy, was unveiled during Obama's administration and made East Asia and China in particular a top priority of the US foreign policy. The Trump administration dramatically upped the ante against China. Back in October, U.S. President Joe Biden said the United States would come to Taipei's aid if it were to come under attack from China, claiming it had a commitment to defend the self-ruled island.
So, besides that, the U.S. has been investing massively into Taiwanese politics and media through NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the rebranded name for the CIA.
China blasted the statement, accusing Washington of meddling in Chinese internal affairs. The US and China are also at loggerheads over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea.
United States in 2021.
Chaos broke out very early in 2021 in the United States. Less than a week into the new year, the world was shocked by footage showing thousands of Americans besieging and storming the Capitol building in the heart of Washington, D.C. The reason? They wanted to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. Many called it an insurrection. Rarely has the world witnessed with such clarity the inherent division in the U.S. political system. What may previously have been a crack in the country's democracy now turned into a wide chasm. On January 13th, a week after the riots, Donald Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to be impeached twice. The House of Representatives began the trial of the controversial figure after he adamantly refused to concede election defeat and incited his fan to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. However, in yet another sign of the failure of the political duopoly, the Republican-held Senate did not find Trump guilty. Just like the first impeachment proceeding against him on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. On January 20th, Biden took office. The veteran Democrat, while on the campaign trail, had tried his best to demonize the incumbent leader and distance himself from his policies. By taking his place at the Oval Office, Biden towed Trump's line on multiple fronts. The Biden administration obediently followed its predecessor's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Despite numerous pledges, it refused to stop supporting Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Biden even blatantly backtracked on his promise to change the U.S. approach towards migrants. People trying to cross into the U.S. faced even more hardship, and those who could get through suffered severe abuse. But that's not all. Getting COVID-19 under control was another pledge that Biden had made. But after almost a year in office, the U.S. remains on top in terms of both infections and death rates. In late December, COVID fatalities reached more than 800,000, but many Americans remained reluctant to get vaccinated as they do not trust their government. During the current administration, rampant gun violence was a major issue for many Americans. Moreover, little has been done to stop global warming, even though the U.S. rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, which Trump had quit. 2021 has not been a good year for civil rights either. Racial equality remains a distant dream for African Americans, despite a long jail term given to Derek Chauvin, a white officer who had violently killed a black man in the previous year. In September, bipartisan negotiations over a police reform bill collapsed. For now, it seems that minorities will still have to live in fear of police brutality.
Canada in 2021.
The United States' northern neighbor, Canada, also experienced a chaotic 2021. In May and June, authorities found nearly 1,200 bodies of indigenous children buried in unmarked mass graves. The grim discovery refreshed the historical plight of the First Nation Canadians. The children of these communities were forcibly separated from their families during the 19th and 20th centuries and taken to infamous residential church schools where many of them suffered abuse and torture and many others went missing. The scandal rocked Canada's self-proclaimed image of human rights defender. A cultural genocide was what an investigative commission concluded, saying thousands had died and many were subjected to physical and sexual abuse at church-run schools in Canada. In 2021, Canada also saw continued protests calling for justice for thousands of missing or murdered Indigenous women. According to the Native Women's Association of Canada, Indigenous women are three times more likely to experience violence during the course of their life than their non-Native counterparts. The damning figure is a clear sign of the deep-rooted colonialism worsened by state inaction. The country also experienced an unprecedented heat wave in the past year, which led to the death of hundreds of people. Wildfires burned for months throughout much of Canada, making it the third worst wildfire season on record. Flooding was another natural disaster that prompted authorities in the Canadian Pacific Coast province of British Columbia to declare a state of emergency in November.
Negotiators of Iran and the P4+1 group have returned to their countries for a New Year break. They began their eighth round of talks this year on Monday. They will return to the Austrian capital on January the 3rd. On Thursday, as delegations were preparing to leave Vienna, Iran's chief negotiator to the talks, Ali Bagheri-Kani, said good progress had been made regarding sanctions removal during negotiations with the P4+1 group over the past days. He said the eighth round of the negotiations mainly focused on that issue. Iran's top negotiator also expressed hope that after a few days of recess, more serious work would be pursued on the issue of sanctions removal. The Islamic Republic has emphasized that if the other parties continue the negotiations in good faith, an agreement is within reach. Senior diplomats from Iran, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany are trying to find a way to remove sanctions against the Islamic Republic and allow the United States to return to the 2015 agreement. Tehran insists that the U.S., which unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018, must remove sanctions in a verifiable manner and provide credible guarantees that it will not violate its commitments again. Iran insists that the lifting of sanctions in a verifiable manner and guarantees are two issues that have to be addressed during the talks.
Because the United States in 2015 did not abide by its key commitments. The United States was supposed to normalize Iranian trade, and the same is true with the Europeans. They were supposed to facilitate the normalization of Iranian business and trade across the globe, but they did the exact opposite.
The United States' unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 agreement has definitely taught Iranians a lesson. All sides in Vienna have stressed that they will do their utmost to expedite the negotiation process. Iran says that it seeks a definitive result through the ongoing talks, emphasizing that Vienna negotiations must end in removal of sanctions. When will that happen? Russia's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna says he believes that an agreement could be clinched before the end of February 2022. Mikhail Yulianov said nobody can say precisely and accurately when an agreement will emerge, but the most important thing is that steady progress is being made. Speculations are rife as to when an agreement will finally emerge. This is reminiscent of the weeks and months before the deal was announced in mid-July 2015. Negotiators of Iran and P4+1 now have to go through a similar exhausting process, all because of the American unilateral withdrawal. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that the pullout was a grave mistake. It has also expressed interest in returning to the agreement. Yet, it is still enforcing the sanctions that were imposed by former President Donald Trump and has refused to lift any of them as a goodwill gesture.
Biden is not a person who shows goodwill. He is, as expected, pursuing Trump's policy of maximum pressure. He is strangling ordinary people as much as possible. These are crimes against humanity, but for Biden, that's fine.
Iran has definitely no illusions about unending American hostility, no matter who is in the White House. Observers believe it has every right to push for verifiable removal of sanctions and credible guarantees from the U.S.
Israel is pressing ahead with its land grab and expansionist policies. On Sunday, Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett announced new plans to almost double the number of Israeli settlers in the occupied Golan Heights. The $317 million plan aims to build 7,300 new settler units in the occupied territory over a five-year time span. Currently, 25,000 Israeli settlers are staying in the Golan Heights. The new plan will attract 23,000 others to the area. The Syrian Foreign Ministry condemned the decision as a dangerous and unprecedented escalation. It has described Israel's settlement construction policy as a war crime, noting that Damascus will use any means permitted by international law to return the Golan Heights to its homeland. Israel captured Syria's Golan Heights in the closing stages of the regime's 1967 war on Arab nations and annexed the occupied territory in 1981, in a move that was not recognized by the international community.
Ever since the very foundation of the Zionist regime back in 1947, everything that the Israeli government has achieved has been at the expense of international law and by means of aggression against the Palestinian people and all of its Arab neighbors. So there's nothing new in Israel's attempt to colonize the Golan Heights.
The UN Security Council, in its Resolution 497, adopted unanimously in December 1981, declared the Israeli decision, quote, null and void and without international legal effect. Regardless of that, former U.S. President Donald Trump recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Syrian territory in 2019. Toward the end of Donald Trump's office in late 2020, several Arab nations, including Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, signed U.S.-brokered normalization deals with Israel in rapid succession. The countries claimed that their moves would benefit the Palestinian people and help establish peace in the region. Only months later, however, Israel escalated the pressure on Palestinians in the West Bank and launched a devastating 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war claimed over 240 Palestinian lives, many of them were children. The recently announced settlements in the occupied Golan Heights are yet another proof that normalization with Israel not only didn't help the oppressed, but only emboldened Tel Aviv to violate international law with impunity. The United States has played an instrumental role in that. As the Israeli Prime Minister said, U.S. President Joe Biden has made it clear that there won't be a change in Trump's policy toward the Golan Heights under his term, practically giving the regime carte blanche to press ahead with its illegal activities.
At the time when Trump announced that he was going to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem and later to recognize Israel's annexation of the West Bank and the Golan Heights, many people in this part of the world, even in Canada, thought that when the Democrats came to power, when Biden came to power, that he would reverse these policies and he would move the embassy back and take away the U.S. approval over Israel's annexations. But in fact, that did not happen, and Biden is continuing Trump's policies in all respects, whether it's on Palestine or whether it's on the Saudi war against Yemen.
Israel's strikes on Syrian soil are another example of the moves. But Syria's repeated complaints to the international community appear to have fallen on deaf ears. That has prompted speculations about a possible Israeli-Syrian war. There is no denying that the Golan Heights will remain a part of Syria. But the silence of international community and the support for Tel Aviv have proven to lead to none other than more death and destruction.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Aliyun alayhi as-salam. To show the just nature of Ali alayhi salam. You can begin from the beginning of his life and you can see it. You can look at it in the middle of his life and you can see it. Or you can look at it at the end of his life, the last days of his life, the last minutes of his life, in fact, and you can see the mercy and justice of Ali alayhi salam. It was in the month of Ramadan, at the time of the morning prayer, in the Masjid of Kufa, when Ibn Muljim, with his poisoned sword, struck a fatal blow on the head of the fasting Imam alayhi salam, as he was trying to get up from his prostration. The deadly strike left a deep wound in the head of Imam Ali alayhi salam that reached the bottom of his brain. A commotion followed after, and Ibn Muljim, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala curse him, was apprehended and brought before Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now look at this mercy of this person. I don't know, you run out of words to try to describe Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam. Him wounded, and he is, you know, seconds away from death. His brain is in two halves. He looks at Ibn Muljim. He sees him bound in ropes, and the ropes were done tight on him, because those who captured him, obviously he killed their master, so they did not take it easy on him. And the ropes were cutting into the flesh of Ibn Muljim. Despite his own agony and pain, he asked the people not to be cruel to his murderer and to have these ropes loosened. What can I say? I am absolutely out of words. How could you describe such a person that in such agony, in front of his companions and family, he's about to die, but a strike that was dealt to him by his worst enemy. Yet Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam wants them to be merciful and kind to him. Loosen his ropes. Please don't hurt him. Who in the face of this earth or in existence would do such a thing, do such an act? Of course, we always say it is only Ali alayhi salam. Even Amir al-Mu'minin salamullahi alayhi, when he was taken to his house and he was put to rest, and his family and his companions were trying to treat his wound, he would ask about his capture. He would ask about his murderer. What happened to him? Is he being fed? Is he being taken care of? Have you guys gave him water? Did you guys take care of him? Who would ask about his murderer in his last minute of death? And he would constantly insist on his sons to be kind and gentle to this ruthless man who deprived humanity out of Ali alayhi salam. But what can I say? Ali alayhi salam is always Ali and will be Ali. Let us take a break, and we come back shortly after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. We said even at the last moments of Amir al-Mu'mineen's life, when he was taken to his house and milk was served to him, he offered his glass of milk that was given to him to his murderer Ibn Muljim himself to drink it. Now, I don't know about you, but if someone would have done this to my father or to my relative or to a friend or to any human being. And me giving him anything is out of the question because of how much pain he has put me through. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he himself offering his own cup of milk, which he needs the most to survive, to his enemy Ibn Muljim, which is alive and well. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, in his will to his son Imam al-Hasan alayhi as-salam. And what a will it is. It's a mind-boggling, hard to comprehend and to fathom will. He says to Imam al-Hasan alayhi as-salam, he says that if you want to take revenge, make sure it's a strike for a strike. Don't use hatred. Don't use vengeance. Don't get carried away because he killed your father. Therefore, you give yourself the right to go even deeper than what he went. You have to make sure a strike for a strike. That's it. And he said, if I manage to live, then I will obviously deal with him my own way. Which means, obviously, he will free him as far as we know, Ali alayhi salam. And he said, feed him from that which you eat. Crunch his thirst from that which you drink. And if I die, a strike for a strike. And when he dies, make sure you do not tamper with his body. Meaning, don't burn it, don't cut it, don't throw it out. Respect it, give it a proper burial. Now, this is the akhlaq of Ali alayhi salam. This is the justice of Ali alayhi salam. That to his worst enemy, to his own murderer, the man who deprived him of his own life. And Allahu A'lam, if Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam lived long enough, how much we would have benefited, how much the Muslim world would have benefited from Amir al-Mu'mineen. Not only did he end the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, but he also dealt strike on us all, and he deprived us of knowledge, mercy, compassion, and justice. Imam Ali alayhi salam was never lenient in the matters of justice, however. Be it on his own life or death, he never differentiated between anything when it comes to justice. Ali, when he was 10, as the first person to accept Islam, to Ali, who was 63 in agony and about to die, never changed, not a single second, not a day, not a single event or occasion that changed him. He was always, always the same. His manners and his justice always remained the same. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله 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 صل على محمد وآله.
Does have tied to Muslim extremists, I don't know. From the day he started his presidential campaign, U.S. President Joe Biden told the world that America wants to go back to Iran's nuclear deal. From that day, Israel started to threaten the world that if the U.S. goes back to the deal, it would take matters into its own hands. So as the talks continued between Tehran and the P4 plus one group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati, and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with the US warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the chief of staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Until then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relek Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are backordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was, Tel Aviv was empty, okay. They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing. It's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
IRIB English Radio.